Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
God is a mystery, and we need to respect this mystery, and maybe that's the whole point. Maybe the whole point why God may give different people different texts and allow for many different interpretations, even from the same text.
The understanding in Christianity is because Jesus is a divine person, he is worthy of worship. Now, I would just sort of, from my own perspective, think that a Muslim would not be comfortable in worshiping Jesus.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello, welcome back to the show. An interesting conversation for you today on whether we need to rethink Islam and the Trinity. I'll be introducing my guest shortly. It's Justin here with Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking every week. And we've exciting news about an upcoming virtual live audience event with John Lennox in early December. We'll give you full details next week, but look out for that. More details about that, how you can register for a free event with John Lennox. That'll be on next week's show that you can find out more. Make sure you don't miss out, though, on news from the show by subscribing to our newsletter. You can find it at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Our show webpage links there to our video channel, our Confident Christianity course 2, extending the discount on that for November, and ways to support the show from there as well. Again, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and links of course to all of the shows from the back catalogue. And last week's climate change discussion has provoked a lot of feedback. We'll be hearing some of that towards the end of today's show. Right now, let's get into today's conversation. Well, today on the programme, we're asking, do we need to rethink the Quran and the Trinity? My guests are Abdullah Galadari and Joshua Sijuwade. When it comes to the deity of Christ and the Trinity, Christians and Muslims, the Bible and the Quran may have more in common than we think, says one of my guests, Abdullah Galadari. Abdullah is an Islamic scholar whose book Quranic Hermeneutics has been creating a wave of interest in the interfaith community and some controversy in the Muslim community. He joins me today to talk about the way the Quran interprets, in his view, the claims about the deity of Christ found in the Gospels. And he's going to be in conversation with my other guest, Christian theologian Joshua Sijuwade. Now, Joshua has a background in discussing the Trinity with Muslims and is a leading exponent of what's sometimes called a monarchical view of the Trinity, as expressed in his PhD thesis on the metaphysics of the Trinity. So today we're having very much, I think, a collegial, friendly discussion on how much Christians and Muslims can in fact be reconciled on Jesus and the Trinity. And if you want links to both my guests, I'll make sure they are there with today's show as well. So welcome, Abdullah and Joshua, to the show today.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Justin.
It's great to have you both with me. Abdullah, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about your background. How did you come to be an Islamic scholar writing this specific book?
Well, of course, in my previous incarnation, I was really not an Islamic scholar, and I wouldn't even call myself an Islamic scholar, maybe even today, but I actually started being an engineer in my previous incarnation. And however, I wanted to actually change career paths. I wanted to really have some answers to the big questions in life, which has always were with me ever since childhood. And so I decided to actually go back to school and get another degree in the humanities and religious studies and Islamic studies. And that's how I actually started working on more research in Islamic studies.
Fantastic. Tell me about this new book then, which I think is based off your research, Quranic Hermeneutics. What does that mean, and what is it about in a nutshell?
Well, Quranic hermeneutics is basically a method that I propose on a way to have some form of interpreting the Quran. It's a method which I call intertextual polysemy, looking how the Quran uses polysemous terms and how they're linking them with each other, both within the Quran and itself and between the Quran as well with, for example, the Bible and other biblical literature.
I was going to say, specifically, one of the chapters I know deals very much with the Gospel of John. Do you want to just talk about how it relates to that and the language used there?
Exactly. So there are three chapters in the book that is fully devoted on the intertextualities between the Quran and the Gospel of John. And I try as much as possible not to really delve at all into theology and Christology. All that I try to show is basically that if we compare the texts themselves, if we compare the Quran with the Gospel of John, they're not really in contradiction. How we interpret each one of those texts may contradict, but the texts themselves do not necessarily contradict one another. And so that was the main focus of the three chapters that I used to show the parallelism between the Quran and the Gospel of John.
So this was the interesting thing I found about the book, is one of your main claims is that the Quran doesn't necessarily reject the Gospels, it interprets them. What do you mean by that?
Well, it means that the Quran basically accepts the Gospels. It's not really trying to say that there was some kind of changes that happened into the text of the Gospels or anything like that. Like a lot of the Muslims, for example, they have the concept of what is called tahrif, or the corruption of the scriptures, of the previous scriptures. And I try to show that is not what the Quran is trying to talk about when it uses the term tahrif. And in reality, it's just trying to tell the people, for example, of the book, well, instead of straying away from your book, but stand upon your book and look into the book. And along with that, the Quran is trying to interpret the Bible. It starts to interpret, for example, in my book, the Gospel of John, interpreting what the Logos is according to the Quran. So it's interpreting it. It's not trying to say, well, this is wrong and this is the correct thing. It's just saying that this is perhaps what it should be interpreted as.
And is this why the book, as I said, is somewhat controversial in parts of the Islamic community, because that is taking quite a different line, obviously, than many Muslims take when it comes to the way they understand the Gospels?
Yes, absolutely. It does create controversy, not only amongst the Muslims, but also with some Christian circles as well. And maybe perhaps the reason is because many religions, especially like Christianity and Islam, they try to win in followers. And so they try to be in competition with one another. And when you want to be in competition with one another, each party wants to show, well, you see, we're different from them, and so we're better. But when you show a lot of commonalities, then some people would say, okay, then what's the difference between now us and them? There's no difference, and therefore, how are we going to compete? So it is controversial in some circles, of course, within the Muslim communities, as well as perhaps in some of the Christian communities.
Well, that's really interesting. Perhaps something we can return to later in the conversation with Joshua. Joshua, welcome to the show as well. It's great to have you on for the first time, both of you, today on the show. Joshua, I've been wanting to have you on for years because I've been aware of your work, your debates that you've had, and your own progression to a very fine scholar and theologian yourself. Tell us a bit of your own background, though. How did you first get into talking about debating the Trinity, especially with Muslims to start out with, Joshua?
Okay, yeah. So it's sort of linked to my own personal sort of story, in that I became a Christian when I was 19 years old, based off of a religious experience. Now, prior to that religious experience, I was living a completely different life, and my main sort of goal in life was American football. I wanted to play American football and, you know, get famous and all those sort of things. But then I had this religious experience that completely changed my life, and it reorientated my thinking. And I realized that actually I want to ask and try and answer the deep questions about life. And so after that experience, I then focused my my thoughts and my life on wanting to sort of develop academically. So I decided to go and study theology. And then I decided to go in sort of the postgraduate level and get a PhD focusing on Christianity. And when I was sort of thinking of PhD topics, I was always interested in, you know, what is the Trinity? And I wanted to use my PhD not just on something that I could, you know, write a, you know, 80,000 word dissertation, but I wanted to do something that actually could help me spiritually in understanding God better. And so I decided to focus in my PhD on the Trinity. And also whilst I was doing that, I was visiting Speaker's Corner as well in London. And yeah, it was a great experience in encountering Muslims and having great conversations with them. And it was even developmental for myself because it was able to help me think through some of the positions that I hold to on the Trinity. And so, yeah, it was sort of falling into study that I got into through this experience. And then just from it, I fell in love with study and theological sort of deep questions and trying to answer them.
Brilliant. And so tell us a bit about sort of where that's taken you in terms of your view of the Trinity. This may be a new concept to many people, this what I've described as the monarchical view of the Trinity. Can you again express it in a nutshell for listeners?
Yeah, so the monarchical view, sort of in a nutshell, is the idea that the one God is identified as the Father. So instead of identifying the Trinity and saying God is tripersonal or three persons in one, the one God is actually solely the Father. However, the Son and the Spirit are divine as well, and they're divine in the same way as the Father is divine. So if we are sort of putting it in a slogan way, you'll say that there are three divine persons, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Each of them are consubstantial. That means they share the same nature. There's no distinction between them there. Yet the one God is identified as the Father. He is the one God because he is the source of all things and he comes from nothing. And so he can bear the name God. And so it's a bit of a strange view for some people when they first encounter it, because they're like, but what do you mean God is not tripersonal? But why I like this view is because I do believe it corresponds to scripture a lot better than the sort of conventional view. And then also I believe it's the historically sort of grounded view. When we look at the history of the church in the first four centuries, what was their understanding of the doctrine of the Trinity? I would sort of, in my sort of opinion, say, well, it was the monarchical view, the idea that the one God is the Father and there are two other divine persons who are consubstantial with the Father. They share the same nature as him.
And does this kind of take us into the territory, which I know is controversial in some Christian circles, of a sort of hierarchical slash kind of the Spirit and the Son being in some way subject to the Father or in some way? How does it interact with those kinds of views?
Yeah, so it definitely would. And I think we can affirm a hierarchy in one sense and then negate it in another sense. And the one that we want to negate is an ontological hierarchy, in that the Son and the Spirit are subordinate to the Father because they have a different nature from him. So, for example, we are subordinate to God because he has a divine nature. We have a human nature. So that would be a type of subordinationism that we want to negate and say, no, that's not correct.
That would be a heresy as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, that would be heretical. That would be incorrect. Yeah, that would be wrong. And it's not something that the monarchical view affirms. But the monarchical view simply affirms that there is a relational hierarchy, in that the Father is greater than the Son based on the relation that he bears to the Son, in that he is the Father, he is the source of the Son. And so that's why there is a distinction. So I normally give an analogy. You can think about it in sort of a family sense. Your father, if you have a father and you have a child, the father and child are different in one sense and they're equal in another sense. They're equal in their nature. So there's no hierarchical subordination when it comes to what they are. But based on their relation, there is a hierarchy. The father in some way should be superior to the son. It would be strange if the son said to the father, go and tidy your room. I mean, that will be strange, but it's not strange when a father says it to their child because of that relational distinction between them. And yeah, so in the Trinity, there's that relational distinction in that the Father is the source of the Son and the Spirit. And so he has a relational superiority. But when it comes to their nature, they share the same nature and they're equally perfect.
Okay, that's very interesting. I'm sure we could do a whole debate, you know, with possibly other points of view on that. But as far as you're concerned, this is a perfectly orthodox way of understanding Trinitarian theology. I mean, I'll be very interested to come back in a moment then to see how that has been helpful for you in engaging with Muslims and their objections to the Trinity in a moment, Joshua. But let's maybe first just define what the problems are. And maybe, Abdullah, you could spell out for us some of the typical objections that a Muslim would have to the idea of the Trinity. I think most people are very aware that, you know, as soon as you get into a discussion between a Muslim and a Christian, one of the first things that's going to arise is, well, how can you believe God is three persons in one, or that there are three gods, or whatever. And just take us to some of the specific passages in the Quran that deal with this, Abdullah, and what the typical objections are from Muslims towards the Trinity as it's typically expressed.
Yes, thank you for that. One of the major issues that the Quran has is about Jesus not being begotten of God. Because the Quran frequently says that Jesus is not begotten of God. And immediately one would say, well, that's obviously something that would go against the Gospel of John. And therefore, there is a contradiction. However, what I try to show is that in reality, that is not what the Quran is trying to suggest. It is not suggesting that the Gospel of John is incorrect in its way of its way describing who Jesus is as the Logos, as the Word that has incarnated in flesh. So in reality, when we do look into the Quranic passages, especially whenever it actually says that Jesus is not begotten of God, every single time it uses the word walad, it says that Jesus is not walad of God, is not begotten of God. But immediately afterwards, it says that whatever God wills, God says be, and it becomes, kun fayakun in Arabic. And so every single time it says, well, don't say walad, don't say begotten, it says kun. But if we try to really understand what those terms really mean in the Arabic language, it is very difficult. What is the nuance in the difference between the concept of tawlid, which is to beget in Arabic, and the concept of takween, which means to become in Arabic? Because both of them means to generate. So both terms really mean to generate. And because both terms really mean to generate, it's very difficult even for people who are Arab speakers to really try to figure out, well, what's really the difference between them? And some might, for example, say, well, maybe tawlid is biological begetting, and maybe takween is just generation through other means. But even in the Arab-speaking world today, for example, we do use the word tawlid for even not necessarily biological begetting. For example, generating electricity, we use the word tawlid. So it just simply means to generate. So what's the difference between tawlid and takween? It's a very, very fine line. There is a nuance which perhaps nobody really knows. But the Quran seems to be very adamant. No, don't say tawlid. Don't say begetting through tawlid, but say generating through takween instead. And so what I argue is that maybe that's what the Quran is trying to interpret the Logos in the Gospel of John. Because in the beginning of the Gospel of John, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And then it says, and the Word was God. Well, what does it mean? Well, of course, a lot of the, for example, dialogues that exist between Christianity and Judaism, they would simply say, well, as soon as John says, and the Word was God, now it became something that is not Jewish. However, I argue that is very much Jewish. Why? Because we all know that the prologue of the Gospel of John is trying to parallel the prologue of Genesis and how creation came to be. And so if we read Genesis independent from the Gospel of John, of course, God is the source of all things that were created. And the word that God speaks to create everything is the Hebrew Yehi, which is from the root Haya, which means let there be. So in other words, be. The Septuagint, for example, uses Genithito. And actually, the word Genithito, coming from the Greek Genomai, means to generate. Now, so in the beginning was the Word. If we understand now that the Word is the word be, which in Arabic would be kun, and it wouldn't be walad, it would be kun, to be. So if we say that the Word is actually the word be, which was with God from the beginning, and then that the Word itself was God, well, why would the Gospel of John say that the Word itself was God? If we do look into the Bible, for example. In Exodus 3:14, how does God actually describe itself to Moses? It says, "Ehia Asher Ehia." I will be who I will be. So God describes itself with the word be, with the root haya, which in Arabic would be kun. So it's as if it's saying akun men akun in Arabic. So I will be who I will be. The Quran usually translates this encounter between God and Moses with inni an Allah. I am who I am, God. So basically, maybe what the Quran is trying to say, don't say walad, because the word walad has no connection with the name of God, has no connection with the word that created everything. However, when we use the word kun, then that is actually the word of be, which describes how everything was created according to Genesis, and is itself associated with the name of God. Actually, in Hebrew, of course, we have the Tetragrammaton, which is, of course, nobody knows how it is exactly pronounced, but it is something like Yahweh, and itself is perhaps rooted in the term Haya, and so perhaps what the Gospel of John is trying to do is that, well, I'm not going to use the name of God, because in the Jewish tradition, putting the name of God or writing the name of God is sometimes considered to be very holy, and that it's usually used like putting instead some other names, like the Lord, like Adonai, Hashem, or sometimes Memra, the word, which perhaps what the Gospel of John here is doing.
So let me just try to summarize this as far as I've understood it then, Abdullah. So when the Quran objects to the idea that God begets, and this would be, you know, the typical objection of shirk, the idea of associating God with other deities and so on, that seems to you normally be taken as an objection to the idea of a Trinitarian view or Jesus as the Son of God and so on. But you say, no, as soon as it said that, it says, don't use this word beget, but rather the word be. Anything God comes from God is kind of immediately generated or something like that. And that this then you find is an interpretation of the Logos in the beginning of John's Gospel. And from that point of view, you're saying, is it then that in your view, it's plausible to believe that the Quran is actually not necessarily discounting in some sense the divinity of Jesus as expressed there, but just simply trying to reinterpret it as not some kind of form of, you know, additional person in this way?
Well, I try to stay away from theology and Christology in the Quran and just comparing the texts. So the texts themselves, they don't contradict one another. Now, what does that mean is a different story. Like, for example, even in the early churches, they had different Christologies, different understandings of who Christ is, the divinity of Christ, and so forth. But did they all have different texts? No, they all used the exact same text. They all used the same Gospels. They didn't use anything different. Yet they reached different conclusions from within the same text. So here in the Quran, you can, of course, you can consider yourself having some kind of an orthodox view of Christ, for example, and still be able to see that in the Quran. You can have maybe an Arian view and still see that in the Quran. You can have a completely different view and completely discounting the divinity of Christ and still see that as well in the Quran. So you can really pretty much have all the different views. And if you ask me personally, I mean, what makes me as a human being right now in front of you? Every single cell of my body that exists today did not exist 10 years ago. So my whole physicality that exists today is very different than what it was 10 years ago. Does that mean I was a different person 10 years ago than I am today? Is my physical body what makes me who I am? I have no idea. I mean, some people would say, well, the humans are made up of, you know, like the body and the soul. And then there's the idea about whether it's the soul is distinct from the body or is part of the body or something like that. Nobody really knows. And of course, there are many different philosophers out there that talk about what is consciousness and what makes a human human and so forth. But if we don't know who we are, then how dare we even try to speculate who God is? Right. So if I can't even tell you what my essence really is, if I don't really know what my essence is as a human being, how will I even be able to determine and interpret the essence of God?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. So, yeah, I know, Joshua, that you have only recently come to sort of read yourself the work of Abdullah and start to interact. So there's a lot you've got to digest here and so on. But what's your initial thoughts on this quite interesting way of understanding and interpreting the relationship of the Quran with the claims there right at the beginning of the Gospel of John?
Yes, yeah, so I find it a very interesting proposal. And something that I would like to look further into, but it's just sort of trying to understand how far the Quran allows you to affirm the divinity of Christ. Because obviously as a Christian or someone who holds to the authority of the council, so the Council of Chalcedon in 451, the affirmation of the divinity of Christ was that he is a fully divine person. And then what we have in Constantinople is that that divinity that he has is the same as the Father. And so what I'm interested to understand is how far you can do that, because also what we find in the councils is that there is an affirmation of a numerical distinction between them. The person who is the Word, who's understood to be the Word in Christian theology, is numerically distinct from the Father. And so this is sort of a question thrown back sort of to Abdullah, just to understand just better and to help me understand your proposal better, is the Word that is in John, according to the Quranic sort of understanding, is it something that's numerically distinct from God, or is it God? Is it numerically identical? So do we have two things there, two numerically distinct things, or do we just have one thing and the Word is just like myself, my Word is something that's me, or do we have something numerically distinct? That's something I'd like to understand.
That's a very fair and good question. So is this be, this kun, is it distinct from God itself? Well, it's very difficult, really, from the Quran to determine whether the kun itself is the essence of God, is in itself God, or is it just maybe a name of God, as it is in the, for example, in the Hebrew Bible, where God is Ehya Asher Ehya, I will be who I will be. It's very difficult, really, to determine exactly what the Quran tries to suggest. But like, for example, one of the passages in the Quran that tries to say about using numbers and the numerical thing, the Quran is very adamant there is no three, there is only one. And a lot of the, for example, Muslims, they usually interpret one of those passages. Like I can tell you what that passage is. It's Quran 4:171, which says, "O people of the book, don't go to extremes regarding your faith and say nothing about God except the truth." And then it says, "The Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, is a messenger of God, and his word, whom he gave to Mary, and a spirit from him. And so believe in God and his messengers. And do not say three, desist, it is better for you. For God is only one God." And a lot of the Muslim interpreters, of course, will usually read this passage as denying the Trinity. But it can be read not necessarily as denying the Trinity, because all it's saying is that don't say three. I mean, if we compare this, for example, with the Athanasian Creed, says like the Father is eternal, the Son eternal, the Holy Spirit eternal, the Father unlimited, the Son unlimited, the Holy Spirit unlimited. And yet there are not three eternals. There are not three infinites or unlimited. It's only one. And the Athanasian Creed frequently says, don't say three, it's only one. And so we can even read this passage in the Quran to actually say, well, don't say three, just say one. So it doesn't really necessarily denounce the Trinity per se, it can be read. And again, that's why I try to make a distinction between what the text says and what theologians usually try to interpret. Because there could be a distinction. We can interpret this perhaps as denying the Trinity, but it can be actually interpreted maybe denying some kind of maybe an Arian kind of Christology in which we shouldn't basically make a distinction. It's only one. I mean, there are many different ways to interpret this, and I just keep the interpretation for the people to make, and I'll just look into the text as they are.
Well, let me come back to you just after a brief break, Joshua, because I'd be interested generally in the way that you've generally kind of encountered these issues among Muslims and just how different Abdullah's way of approaching this issue is, as far as you can see. We're talking about the Trinity, the Bible, the Quran, on Unbelievable Today, and some quite interesting, unusual views being expressed, quite a radical new way of perhaps finding common ground between the Bible and the Quran, from one of my guests, Abdullah Galadari, today. He's in conversation with Joshua Sijuwade, who's a leading exponent of Trinitarian theology in the UK. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show. We're talking about the Quran and the Trinity today with my guests Abdullah Galadari and Joshua Sijuwade. Is there more common ground than we may have thought between them both? That is the contention of Abdullah and his book, Quranic Hermeneutics. And Joshua, you're normally engaged, obviously, in discussions and debates with Muslims who say there really is a strong divide between the Quran and the Bible and, you know, a Christian and Islamic view of God and so on. I mean, first of all, sketch out kind of where typically the debate tends to revolve when you are having this conversation with Muslims. And then we'll talk a bit about, you know, how you think Abdullah's synthesis, if you like, kind of speaks to all of this. What do you find are the typical views, though, that you're encountering and the way you tend to respond to them yourself, Joshua?
Yeah, so generally, you normally see a lot of Muslims, when I'm speaking to them, is that there's the understanding of the Trinity is something which is not affirmed by the Quran or Islamic theology. It's not possible that it could be, specifically because you have this equating of God, Allah, with another being, a being that's numerically distinct from him. And that is something which cannot be. And if my understanding, it's an unforgivable sin to associate partners with God. And so the understanding is that if a Muslim would say, if we accept the Trinity, we are affirming that the idea that there are three divine persons, the Son and the Spirit, are consubstantial. They share the same nature as the Father. So in a way, you are associating partners with him. And so that would be what sort of one issue that they would say, well, clearly the Quran says you cannot affirm that. And so that's something that you cannot hold to. And then a general objection that you'll find is normally the philosophical aspects, where they'll say, well, there's good reason why the Quran even says that. It's not even just because it's not that Allah has these partners, it's that it's not even logically possible. It's not metaphysically or logically possible that there could be two other divine persons in addition to Allah. So this idea of having three persons, and then also you're saying there is only one God, there seems to be some form of contradiction there. So generally, it's the idea theologically that God has said this is just not correct. And then secondly, you sort of see a philosophical objection, which is, well, it just doesn't make sense. It's incoherent. You cannot have three divine persons and one God.
And is your work generally speaking to the second of those two objections, saying that it is logically coherent? Is that where you would come down?
Yes, yeah. So I sort of work more, I would say, academic. Sort of my academic writings is normally on the philosophical aspects of Christianity. I've been trying to deal with the sort of logical problem of the Trinity issues. And so that's mainly where my focus is. But I think sort of the view that I'm sort of defending does speak to that first issue as well, in a way.
Okay. I mean, just very briefly, yeah, just before we come back to Abdullah's point there, then, when you're typically down at Speaker's Corner and you're meeting those common objections to the Trinity, how does this monarchical, this more hierarchical view, if you like, of the Trinity help to engage people's objections there?
Oh, yeah. I think it, for me, it deals with the general problems that you'll find, because there is no philosophical incoherence, because the idea here is that the one God is identified as the Father. And so when I'm normally discussing this sort of issue, I would start off by saying, firstly, the term God is an ambiguous word, and it's quite evident that it is ambiguous, because we can affirm many things as God, and we're not necessarily meaning the same thing. So God is an ambiguous word. But, and given this ambiguity, we have at least two ways of understanding it. And what we find in the Bible and what we find sort of in church history is that there are these two ways. One way is using the word God as a name for a being. And another way is using the word God as a predicate or an adjective. So sort of at a general level, you can see this with the word brown. Brown can be used as a name for something, but it can be used as an adjective to sort of describe a characteristic of someone. And so sort of I would say with a monarchical view, what you understand is that there's one way of using the word God as a name, and there's one way of using the word God as an adjective. When we use the word God as an adjective, it applies equally to each of the persons, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So we can affirm the Son is God, and we can affirm the Holy Spirit's God, as with the Father, because they have that sort of characteristic of being perfect. They are divine, and so they can be predicated the word God. However, with that first usage of the word God as a name, that's solely given to the Father alone. And we see this throughout the New Testament, where 99% of the passages would be saying the term ho theos, the God, applies to the Father. And you see actually in the New Testament, sometimes it's just common knowledge that they don't even use the word Father. So when Paul is speaking, he would say the God, you know, the God, or he'll say the God and Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, or he'll use the word God for the Father, and he wouldn't even need to use the word Father, because it's just common knowledge that the name God was given to the Father. And so when you're then dealing with a philosophical issue, you would simply say, well, when we're trying to count gods, when we're trying to be monotheistic, which meaning of the word God is important? Well, the meaning of the word God that's important is the name. How many divine persons bear the name God in the Trinity? There is only one, the Father alone, because he is the sole source, the ultimate source of all things. The Son and the Spirit eternally come from him. And so that's why he can bear this name God. And so there is no philosophical problem, because there's only one God, and that one God is applicable to the Father alone.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really a really helpful way of helping to spell out the way you would then engage engage this issue with a Muslim who has this objection. Yeah. So coming back to Abdullah then, I mean, again, as I said before, you've only recently encountered this kind of way of maybe bringing together the Quran and John's Gospel in this way. How do you think it speaks to it, especially, you know, given what Abdullah had to say there in that last segment about you know, in answer to your question about the way, whether or not this is a different being, you're talking about two different sort of things or whatever.
Yes, yeah. I'm very, like I said before, I'm very interested in this proposal, and it's definitely original because I haven't encountered it before in sort of my own limited experience. But something I am just slightly weary of is this sort of divide between the text and the theology of the text. Because I know, as Abdullah, you were saying, is that you are only looking at the text and you're not trying to step into the theological sort of issues. But my only issue is that I think in my own mind, you can't really divide those two things. There is sort of, I would say, a false dichotomy there, because the text, well, I would say even in a Christian perspective, the text is read in light of the teaching of the church. And so we interpret the text in light of it. And so if you just have the text alone, you can have hundreds of interpretations and hundreds of different ways of understanding it. Textually, it could mean this or it could mean that. But when we want to come to the truth of the matter on an issue, I think we need to understand what the interpretation is so we can correctly apply it to our lives. And so I would say the way then you have to do that is by then battling with the theology, because if the Quran does allow us to, you know, affirm this divinity of Christ, then it does seem to me sort of, if we look at the theological sense, well, the divinity of Christ understood in a Christian context is that he shares the same divinity as the Father. It's not a lesser divinity. And so then what you are really saying is that there are, in a way, that there's allowed to be two divine persons in an Islamic worldview. That's sort of in my opinion. But if you just go with the text, you would say it just allows it to be open. But I think if you're going to understand I would say, the issue further, we have to also battle with the theology. And I think the theological implications might be troublesome for bringing the Islamic view and the Christian view together.
Abdullah.
Thank you so much for that, Joshua. Yes, I do. I do, of course, understand why people would want to know what would the interpretation be. But as I said, I mean, if I don't even know what makes me me as a human being, I mean, is my physical body what makes me? Is my soul what makes me? Is my spirit what makes me? I mean, you can even think of the human as a trinity, right? With body, soul, and spirit. Or even a different kind of trinity according to the Quran. According to the Quran, it's even a different kind of trinity. You've got God's created the human from dust and from water, made it out of into clay, and then breathed into this clay from God's spirit, and this person became alive. So there's this kind of also a trinity of a human. Because if we think of the four basic elements in the ancient world, the human is made out of earth, made out of water, made out of air. The only thing he's not made out of is the fire, perhaps. But the three elements, the three basic elements of the ancient world is what the human being is made out of. So the human is made out of three elements, maybe the metaphysical things such as the soul, spirit, and body, and so forth. But all of these things, I mean, if I don't even know what makes me me in reality, the truth of the matter, what is my essence, if I have no idea what that is, then maybe before I even try to speculate, well, what is the essence of God, and try to understand the truth of the matter of God's essence, and if God is a trinity, and if God is three different elements or three different persons of the trinity, well, maybe I should first ask myself, well, what am I? And if I figure that out first, and then maybe I can look into theology. So I do fully understand. I mean, many people, okay, but what does it mean? We need to know what it means. But I think maybe we need to have this kind of humility and humbleness that maybe these things about God is a mystery. And one of the things about the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Oriental churches as well, they emphasize negative theology. We can say maybe what God is not, but it's very difficult to say what God is, because God is a mystery, and we need to respect this mystery. And maybe that's the whole point. Maybe the whole point why God may give different people different texts and allow for many different interpretations, even from the same text, looking into the early churches, for example, and their big debates about Christology. Well, maybe because the goal is for people to seek the truth, to seek God. And if everybody said, well, God is A, B, C, D, then nobody will be seeking the truth, because everybody will tell you, well, God is A, B, C, D. But if God, as you said, Joshua, is very ambiguous, that's the beauty. Because God is very ambiguous, God is a mystery, and so it allows for people to try to seek who God is and what the truth really is. And maybe that's the purpose of why God wanted to create humans.
Yeah. So that's interesting. My only sort of thought on that would be that I do understand what you're saying, but I feel we also need to take into account that there is an understanding that we are to have a relationship with God. So God is relational. And so if we are to stand in a relationship with God, we need to have some or a good understanding of the God that we are in a relationship with. If I was in a relationship with my wife, but I absolutely knew nothing about her and I just said she was a mystery, it won't be a very good relationship. But there is an understanding that we are in a relationship with God. We stand in this relationship. And if we are to be able to fulfill the expectations of the relationship, and for God to fulfill the expectations that he has as well for us, then we will need to have some understanding. And so what I think is good to sort of emphasize is, in sort of the Christian theology, we would say that you can apprehend what God has revealed of himself, but you cannot comprehend it, in that we are not going to fully understand everything about God. But because God has revealed things about himself, we can apprehend it. We can come to some sort of a conceptual understanding of these things. Because if we can't, then I don't know how we can enter into a authentic relationship with him. And so for me personally, sort of, maybe it's my philosophical sort of hat that I wear all the time, but I don't really like the word mystery, in that I think I do believe mystery, there is always a mystery or mystical element of theology, But I do believe that sometimes we pull the mystery card too early when I don't think we have warrant to do that yet. Because I would say if we've been able to develop our understandings of many things in the world, why can't we do the same thing for God? And not God from an a priori perspective, in that I'm sitting on my couch and God hasn't revealed anything and I'm just going to think and know about God. But in a posteriori perspective, saying because God has revealed things about him and based on this revelation, he wants us to be in a relationship with him, then we should be able to understand things about him. And I think the doctrine of God, the nature of what God is extremely important if we're going to have that type of relationship. And so for me, the doctrine of the Trinity, I would say, and the incarnation of the Son as the person of Jesus are fundamental things that I think we can come to a good level of understanding of.
And I just wanted to come in on this, Abdullah, because we've spoken about just those first verse or two of the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the way that you do believe that speaks both to, obviously, the Hebrew account of that, and the way that you believe the Quran is, if you like, speaking to that. But of course, as that passage goes on, John says, and the Word became flesh and lived among us. This is, you know, the central claim, if you like, of Christianity, that Word, that Logos, that God became human, the incarnation. So now, is that a kind of fundamental separating point between Islam and Christianity? Most people would assume it is. What's your view on the incarnation specifically?
I don't think it does have any issues with the understanding from the Gospel of John, because as you just said, the thing is, in the Quran, for example, it does say that the likeness of Jesus unto God is like that of Adam. He created him of dust and then said to him, be, and he becomes. So we do see, because a lot of people also usually think that the word be is the word of creation. But in this passage, there's also a distinction between creation and being. There's this ontological issue, a distinction between them, because it says that God created him of dust. It's a past tense. God created the physical flesh and then said to the physical flesh, be. And so this be now becomes into that flesh after it had been already created. So I don't see in here that the Quran, again, it's not necessarily contradicting the Gospel of John at all. And it does affirm that the word, that the kun, has become in the flesh, in the form of Jesus. There's no distinction in there. And to answer Joshua, let me actually ask Joshua a question. Do you have a good relationship with yourself?
That's the first time you answer. I hope, I don't know. Do I have a relationship with myself? I don't think so. In that relations are normally dyadic, in that there is at least another thing that's numerically distinct from a being that you then stand in a relationship with. So I don't know if I have a relationship with myself, but I don't know. It's something I need to think about.
What's the point of the question there, Abdullah?
Well, that's a good answer. My next question would be, you said you have a good relationship with your wife, correct?
Mm-hmm. All yes. Right. Well, I try to.
You try to. Well, that's great. Yeah. The thing is, do you know the relationship between your wife's physical flesh, her soul, and her spirit, the relationship between them? Because honestly speaking, if I ask myself this question, what is the relationship? I have no idea if I have a soul, a spirit, or even if my physical flesh is actually part of my own essence. But I have absolutely no idea, to be very honest and to be very truthful to myself, I don't know what's the relationship between my soul and my flesh, my body, or between those and the spirit. I have no idea what the relationship is between them. But that doesn't mean that I cannot have a relationship with myself or relationship with any other human being who perhaps is also made out of a flesh, a spirit, and soul. So knowing the relationship between them does not really tell me that I cannot really have a very good relationship with that being without necessarily knowing the relationship between the essence or the different elements of the essence of that being.
Yeah. Just in response to that, I would agree with you in part, but I would say that you can be in a relationship with an entity, even if you don't know many things about them, or anything about them. You can stand in a relationship or in a relation, but the idea was about the value of the relationship. A relationship is bettered if I know that being better. And so, I have, you know, a relationship with the Queen of England, even though she doesn't know who I am, but I am in a relation with her in that I am a subject of her. But my relationship is not good because she doesn't know anything about me. But if I was, let's say, one of her children or grandchildren, my relationship will be better. The only reason being is because we know each other better. And so just the idea about the soul, my wife's relationship with me is better if I know more about her soul, because her soul is the seat of her thinking, her emotion, her what she likes, her wants, her desires. Those are things which are rooted in the soul. And so if I knew her soul better, that means I knew her wants better, her desires better, then I will know her 1,000 times. I'll have a 1,000 times better relationship than if I just knew her physically. So my idea here is that the relationship, I think, is better if we know the relata, the thing that we're standing in a relationship with, to a greater extent than if we didn't. And so the value is just a little bit greater. Mm.
This is so fascinating. I'm really enjoying this sort of metaphysical discussion on the nature of soul, spirit, body, and so on. Mm-hmm. I mean, coming back, I would love to return to this issue, though, of the incarnation of Jesus, which again is, you know, at one level highly mysterious, and we are in a sense trying to grasp a mystery when we just use that word. But to what extent do you feel like Abdullah's view that actually there is some way of understanding it in the Quran, and that it's not necessarily a complete contradiction in Islam? What's your take on that, Joshua?
Yeah, I think, again, I think if you're just going at the textual sort of level, and I'm not a textual scholar, so I can't really come back to you on sort of your interpretation of, sorry, your sort of exegesis. But I would say at the textual level, from what I've seen at the sort of prima facie level, it is, you know, something that can sort of work together. But it's just sort of when we think of, again, the theological implications of this, it seems for me to be problematic. Because sort of a question which I'll like you to answer in a second as well, is about the idea of worship of Jesus. Because the understanding in Christianity is, because Jesus is a divine person, he is worthy of worship. Now, I would just sort of, from my own perspective, think that a Muslim would not be comfortable in worshipping Jesus. But the understanding in Christianity from the first century was that they did worship him. And I've just a verse that I'd like to sort of just read here. It's just from Exodus, where God says, "Do not worship any other God, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God." Now, God is saying that soul worship is given to him alone. But then what we see sort of in the New Testament, specifically after the resurrection appearances, is that there is this sort of now dyadic devotional sort of pattern where cultic veneration is now given to Jesus. He's prayed to, his name is invoked, he's, you know, people baptize in his name, there's a Lord's Supper, hymns and psalms and spiritual songs are given to him. And so my understanding is that there is a recognition now that Jesus, if he is the incarnate Son or the incarnate Word, he is worthy of worship, and that's what's done. But then my problem is I think Islam will affirm the idea that worship is given to Allah alone, and none of his prophets are worthy of worship. But then you see in Christianity, Jesus is worshipped, and he's worshipped as a God. And so my problem is how would you sort of square that together?
Very good question. Excellent question. And I do discuss, not using these terms, but the idea of what it would mean. From the Quranic perspective, as you said, you're right. The Quran does say that worship is only to God. But we also see something very interesting in the Quran. The Quran says that God tells the angels, "I will form from clay the shape of a human or flesh. And when I breathe into it, and when I form it and breathe into it from my spirit, bow down towards it." So in other words, it's as if the angels are now worshiping this flesh. Now, if we look again into the text itself and the words and the polysemy that the Quran is using, the word it uses when it says that when God is speaking to the angels, when I form it, and it uses the word sawaituhu. And it's the same root word used frequently in the Quran whenever God establishes on its throne, fastawa ala al-arsh. So it's the same word. So it's as if this forming of the human is the way that God actually establishes on its throne. And then it says, and when I breathe into it from my spirit. So now the spirit of God is inside this flesh, which is formed or established just as God established its throne. Therefore, we could imagine that this flesh has now become the throne of God. And so when the angels, according to the Quran, were perhaps to bow before it, they're not really bowing before the flesh, but they're bowing before God, who is now incarnate in that flesh. The Spirit of God is in that flesh. So you can have that kind of an understanding as well from the Quran. So again, without looking into the theology or the Christology, the Quran does allow for that kind of an interpretation about even whether it is okay to worship God in a different form. And I wouldn't necessarily say that you're worshiping someone other than God. You're only worshiping God, but you're worshiping God maybe in its throne. I mean, even if we look into the Muslims today, they're bowing every day towards Mecca, which is, of course, where the Kaaba is. And it's the imagined to be the temple of God or the house of God. But every Muslim would tell you, well, in reality, we're not really worshiping the Kaaba. We're worshiping God, and the Kaaba is only symbolizing the house of God. So, I mean, who knows? I mean, there are multiple of interpretations that one can interpret, but what does it really mean when God told the angels to bow before this flesh he had formed? It could be perhaps the incarnation of God. It could be perhaps just a symbol of God. But it doesn't mean that worship cannot be done to God through a different, if you like, entity or being or even like the stones of the Kaaba at the end of the day, right? It's you're still worshiping God through that.
Joshua, yeah. what do you make of that?
Yeah, so my only issue is that I think I would say it depends, again, what you're understanding by worship, because you're saying worship sort of applies to this idea of bowing down. But what I see sort of in the New Testament is that in the Second Temple period, and even prior to that, worship, and when I'm using the word worship, I'm using cultic veneration, devotion to a being, that was given to God alone. And that was the way that the Jews were able to distinguish themselves as monotheistic from the pagan sort of religions, because they would not sacrifice in the pagan temples. And that was the one thing that they would not do. And because their understanding is that it's not even the belief that you hold, it's the way that you practice. It's what you do as a worship devotional pattern that distinguishes you as a Jew, as a monotheist. And so the understanding is that this was such an important issue that if we worship a being that's not God, then that is idolatry. And so what then we see is when there's sort of this resurrection appearance that happens to the disciples, is that they now then, as we see in the book of Acts and later in the writings of Paul, that there is this cultic veneration that's given to Jesus. And it's not given to God through Jesus, but it's actually given to Jesus himself as a distinct individual. And so my problem is that I don't think Islam would affirm that, because as I was saying, there's at least six sort of characteristics of this false name, not invoking the name of God, but invoking the name of Jesus. There is baptism. So the initiation into the Christian sort of religion was not done through actually, just the name of God, His Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, but also what the disciples were using. They were using the name of Jesus. We baptize you in the name of Jesus. Now, for me, again, that seems to be problematic, because you don't see that happening in any other sort of strand of Judaism. Because for them, that would be idolatry. But Christians saw that actually, no, this can be done. We can pray to him. We can invoke his name. We can baptize. We can have a sacrificial meal in his name. We can sing hymns to him. And so what I'm trying to say is that it seems to me that there was a complete elevation of Jesus to the same level as the Father. And so I don't know if Islam would be able to affirm that and say, well, the same worship that we give to Allah can also be given. And the same worship I'm talking about here can also be given to his prophets. We can, maybe there's an understanding that we can bow down to individuals because the humans sit on the throne of God. But can we have this cultic veneration that actually would have been seen in Judaism to be idolatry? Can we do that in Islam?
We're going to go to a break and we'll see that. Finish discussing this. It's been a really, really interesting discussion, though, from both sides today, folks. Abdullah Galadari and Joshua Sijuade join me as we continue to talk about the Quran and the Trinity, whether we need to rethink the relationship between the two. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Some exciting news about an upcoming virtual live audience event with John Lennox for you next week. We'll give you the full details on that, but you can register. You'll be able to register from next week for that event. If you enjoy the show, you're listening via podcast, do rate and review us. It helps others to discover the program. And if you enjoy podcasts, you might enjoy the Profile podcast as well. Tonight on the Profile here on Premier Christian Radio, Nigerian American actress and comedian Yvonne Orji has just been announced as the host of this year's Emmy Awards. Well, she'll be talking on the show about her new book, Bamboozled by Jesus, and it's a two-parter on the Profile this weekend. I'll be talking to C.S. Lewis scholar Michael Ward about his role in that new C.S. Lewis movie we've been hearing so much about, and his new book, After Humanity, a guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. So two great guests on the Profile tonight at 8 p.m. and on the Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from. Now, coming up next week here on Unbelievable, does the church have a masculinity problem, we'll be asking. I'm going to be joined by Kyle Thompson of the US men's ministry Undaunted Life. He says that the church needs to man up, that men aren't attracted to church because it's become too feminized. Well, on the other side of the debate, Martin Saunders, author of The Man You're Made to Be, will be arguing that we actually need to drop some of these male stereotypes, treat people as people, and that a hyper-masculine approach to church can be dangerous for both men and women. So that's Unbelievable. Same time next week. Hope you enjoy it. Your feedback and ways to get in touch coming up later. Let's get back into the final part of today's discussion. Final part of our discussion today on the Trinity, the deity of Christ, the Quran, the Bible. Is there more common ground than we may have thought, asks Abdullah Galadari, one of my guests today. His book, Quranic Hermeneutics, has some really interesting, groundbreaking, sometimes controversial ideas on the way that he believes there is a commonality between the Gospel of John especially and the way the Quran speaks about Jesus and the Trinity. He's been in conversation today with Joshua Sijuade, and I'll make sure there are links to both of them, their academic profiles and their writing, so you can pursue this at more depth. I do want to come to the kind of question of to what extent this does build a bridge between the Quran and the Bible, Christianity and Islam, in a moment, Abdullah. But just responding, first of all, to Joshua's point that he believes there is something quite different about the kind of worship offered to Jesus than might be offered to a revered individual who, you know, God is working through or whatever. And he just doesn't see that could really fly in Islam when you look at the way Islam, you know, really draws a sharp distinction about the kinds of worship that can be offered. So any quick response to that before we move ahead?
Sure, and I'd like to thank Joshua for that comment. And that's the reason I try to make a distinction between the text and the theology or the Christology that can be interpreted from that text. When we do look into the texts of the Gospels and the Quran, we don't see the contradiction. We don't see, for example, because it can be read in the Gospels that, yes, maybe you can worship Jesus as an entity, or maybe not necessarily so. Maybe that's not what the word worship, even in the Gospel of John, after Jesus's glorification, and what did it mean that they were worshiping Jesus. So there is it's open to interpretation, even within the Gospel. How was that interpreted by some Christian communities? That's their interpretation. But the texts themselves, the Quran and the Gospel, when we put them together, we don't see the contradiction. So that is why I think maybe instead of looking into, well, what's the differences between Christianity and Islam? If we think as if Islam is just maybe like, let's call it the Muslim church, and then what we could do is we can have some kind of an ecumenical council and bring everybody together just like the early churches had whenever they had their debates, interpreting the same text, the same gospels. They were not interpreting different gospels, different texts, the same text. So when we can bring them together, the Muslims and the Christians, and say, okay, so these are the different variations of different theologies, and this is your theology. But at the end of the day, we'll keep the texts themselves instead of our interpretations of them. We'll keep the texts themselves as our mediators. They're the ones that would mediate our understanding rather than the other way around.
It's a very interesting to hear you say that, Abdullah, because the question I wanted to get to, and I'll have Joshua comment on this in a moment, is what kind of a bridge are you building here between Islam and Christianity? And it's very interesting you use that idea of, well, maybe we could even come to regard Islam as another essentially interpretation of Christianity. You've got your Catholics, you've got your Protestants, you've got your Baptists, and then you've got your Muslims, all using essentially the same text. To that degree, I mean, presumably, I mean, is it your view that a Christian does not need to become a Muslim, that a Muslim does not need to become a Christian, that essentially we're all part of the same thing, just different interpretations of the same text?
Well, according to the Quran itself, for example, in chapter 5 of the Quran, Surah Al-Ma'idah, it repeatedly says that the people of the book need to abide by their book. It says that for example, the Jews need to abide by the Torah, the Christians need to abide by the gospel. And it uses present tense. It doesn't use past tense. It doesn't say that you should have used the Torah or you should have used the gospel. It says that in the present tense, that they have to abide. And it actually says that, O people of the book, you abide, or you are standing upon nothing unless you abide by the Torah and the gospel. And what is interesting is that some Muslims, for example, the way they would interpret these passages in the Quran, they would say, oh, that's abrogation. These are abrogated verses, they're canceled verses, and newer verses came later, abrogating the former verses. But what is interesting is that according to Muslim tradition, some of the Muslim traditions say that the last passage that was revealed in the Quran is basically that today I have perfected your religion and completed it and completed my providence to you and accepted Islam as your religion. And of course, the word Islam is typically now understood or interpreted as the religion of Islam, because the Quran might have simply said, and I accepted the surrender to God as your religion. The question is, where is this passage in the Quran? It's also from chapter 5 in Surah Al-Ma'idah. So if the final passage believed by some of the Muslim traditions is in the same chapter in the Quran, which talks about that the people of the book must abide by their own books, then how can we even try to bring up the idea, well, those are abrogated verses and there are newer. I mean, we're talking about the same chapter, which some Muslims believe the final revelation of the Quran is saying that the people of the book must abide by the gospel and the Torah. So to answer your question is, according to the Quran, yes, very much, the Jews must abide by the Torah, or otherwise they would be in trouble. And the Christians must abide by the gospel, or otherwise they would be standing upon nothing. And what's interesting is that there is another passage in the Quran which says that the Jews say that the Christians stand upon nothing, and the Christians say that the Jews stand upon nothing, even though they are both reading the book. And the same thing are those who have no knowledge say the same. So in other words, anybody, according to that Quranic passage, anybody who says that the Jews stand upon nothing or the Christians stand upon nothing, according to the Quran, they have no knowledge. So they are standing upon something. And what is that something? That's the Torah. That's the gospel.
So Joshua, coming to you, I'd be interested to know just how novel a way of approaching this is compared to the Islamic, you know, thinkers and scholars you normally engage with on these issues, and whether you think this is a kind of valid way of creating a kind of a bridge, a kind of you know, a common understanding that these are all different ways into the same text. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, what's your view on this, Joshua?
Yeah, so it is very novel, and Yeah, very fascinating, I would say. Because I haven't encountered that. Normally, what I would see from, you know, Muslim, and this is learned in Muslims as well, they would just simply say there is an incompatibility there at the textual level, and then they would say at the theological level. But it's just made me rethink sort of the textual sort of incompatibility. Is that really there? And is it just more at that sort of theological sort of level? And so I think, yeah, for my own sort of, you know, limited understanding of the textual sort of issue, I would say, yeah, it's great. And it seems to definitely establish that bridge. But then where I was sort of, what I was saying before was, I think you can't really divorce though the theological implications. And so just another thought sort of about that would be, we focus on the incarnation, we focus on the Trinity, but when it comes to something like the atonement, would that be something which can be affirmed by Muslim? I would hesitate, you know, to say yes, that it can. I would say clearly they would say there is no, the soteriological system of Islam is incompatible with that of Christianity. But I would say even the atonement is more fundamental, even at a textual level, because the textual level is quite clear that Christ was a sacrifice for the sins of humanity. And so for me, I would say, is it because we've just focused sort of more at the sort of incarnation and Trinity level? But when we come to other doctrines, which are fundamental in Christianity, like the atonement, can that incompatibility sort of be seen there? I would struggle to say that. And that would be sort of problematic for me.
It's so interesting. I wish we had more time maybe to go through some of those other aspects in that sense, but we're going to have to leave it here. And I just want to say thank you for a really fascinating exchange. As you can tell, Abdullah, Joshua and myself are both relatively new to the way you approach these texts, but it's I should say thanks to Jacob Varghese, who was a friend of mine on the show, who suggested this topic in the first place. And I think there's a lot of people very interested in what you're saying and the connections you're drawing, Abdullah, even while they're still struggling to sort of maybe, you know, understand exactly how it all maps out theologically, because that's obviously something it sounds like you're very keen to be understood, not to be trying to make a theological case here necessarily. Just remind us as we close out what your hope is ultimately for this. Do you want to see a kind of more of a rapprochement between Islam and Christianity through your work, or are you simply saying, hey, here's some interesting facts about the way the texts speak to each other? What's your ultimate goal in all of this, Abdullah?
Yes, I would like to. I do hope that, of course, that Christians and Muslims could get to see that their texts, their scriptures are not in contradiction. Maybe their interpretation of their texts could be in contradiction. That is a possibility. But the texts themselves are foundational. And if I would like to use maybe Joshua's term in his theological discourse about grounding. So if we look into grounding theology into the scripture themselves, so if we will ground those theologies into scripture and see if they do hold things, because at the end of the day, it's just theology is an interpretation of the text. And maybe, yes, we try to find out more about God, but we should also realize that God is infinite. God is indescribable, is beyond words. It's like, for example, if someone who has never tasted anything sour, how will you be able to describe to them what a lemon tastes like? You will try to use as many metaphors as you like and different interpretations and theologies or maybe we can call it lemonologies or things like that. But at the end of the day, nobody will really perfectly understand it until they actually taste it for themselves. And hopefully when we do taste the divine ourselves, maybe then we can better understand the divine.
Maybe. Any final thoughts from you, Joshua, as we close out?
Yeah, so I'm really happy about, you know, sort of even changing the conversation between Muslims and Christians, because it is sort of always that, oh, we, you know, one side is saying, well, you know, we've got this better than you. And I think sort of Abdullah sort of saying, actually, there's a way for us to come closer on this issue, maybe still with our distinctions, but that we can come closer on some certain things, specifically at the textual level, I would say is really good. And it's something to sort of be favoured.
Great. Well, thank you both for being with me on the show. It's been a great conversation. I'll make sure there are links from today's show if you want to find out more about the work of Joshua or Abdullah. But for now, both, thank you very much for being with me.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
What did you make of today's discussion? Email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we've got some of your emails coming up in just a moment's time. You can follow us, of course, on social media, facebook.com/premierunbelievable for our Facebook channel. You can find me on Twitter @unbelievablejb and send me your thoughts that way. We've got some new social media platforms for the show coming up soon as well that we'll be directing you to. Thanks to everyone who's been getting in touch recently about the show. Zach Alexander got in touch to say that both Unbelievable and the other podcast I run, Ask NT Write Anything, have played incredibly powerful roles in restoring my faith and gaining a sense of solace about the robust intellectual tradition of Christians out there to defend it. And you're very kindly, Zach, you asked in your message, what's the best way to become a monthly donor or partner? Well, there are links from today's show. If you're in the USA and you'd like to partner with us, then we'd love you to give via Premier Insight. It's our US charity supporting the work of Premier across the USA. So that's the place to go for that, premierinsight.org/unbelievable show. If you want anywhere else in the world, you can go to the link with the at the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and give. Both links available from the podcast in the info if you want to check those out. Thanks for getting in touch though, Zach. It's lovely to hear how the show has been such a blessing on your own life. Duncan got in touch a little while ago now in response to a skeptical listener. I think it was Phil Stilwell, one of our atheist listeners, who was concerned about a misquotation from Aldous Huxley regarding his need for there not to be a God, i.e. no underlying meaning in life. And Phil was questioning whether actually this was, you know, a genuine quote from Huxley, whether he ever said anything like that. You get in touch, Duncan, to say Huxley does state this in some of his writing. Here's a quote in reference. I had motive for not wanting the world to have a meaning, consequently assumed that it had none, and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in pure metaphysics. He is also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do, or why his friends should not seize political power and govern in the way that they find most advantageous to themselves. For myself, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation, sexual and political. There you go. That was published in Aldous Huxley's Ends and Means back in 1937. Thanks for that. Other bits of feedback. Let's go to your thoughts on last week's debate, the science of climate change. Now, this was Antonia Godbert and Hugh Ross from Reasons to Believe, both essentially, at one in terms of their concerns around climate change, differences in the way that they think that should be tackled. But lots of interesting responses here. Tom is a non-Christian listener who got in touch to say, really great to see the issue being covered. Good discussion with a lot of important points raised. One thing I would say, though, is that there has been a scientific consensus around this issue for a number of decades now and a recognition for the need for societal change. It hasn't happened yet, though, and now even self-styled anti-alarmists like Hugh recognise that we need to make some real progress on this in a very short window of time. So on balance, I feel that complacency is a greater threat than alarm or a heightened sense of urgency. I believe that meaningful action will come from an honest reckoning with the scale and severity of the situation. This may be difficult or alarming for some, but ultimately can be profoundly motivating. It's easy to take pot shots at Extinction Rebellion, but ultimately they've done much to get the issue up the agenda using peaceful means over the past 2 years. Perhaps we all need to search our souls to ask what we're doing on this and be a little slower to pass judgment on the sincere efforts of others. That's Tom Bennett, who's an architect and climate activist. Benjamin is a climate physicist based in Singapore. He says he enjoys listening to both Unbelievable and Ask NT Write Anything. And he says, climate science didn't feature prominently in the discussion. Nevertheless, I'd like to commend Antonia's representation of the science and her trust in the climate science community. Climate science is a highly interdisciplinary subject. Thankfully, the global climate science community is appropriately diverse, encompassing physicists, chemists, geologists, oceanographers, statisticians, and others. As a climate scientist, I would like to emphasize that the vast majority of climate scientists would agree with the central conclusions of the most recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. Converging lines of evidence clearly demonstrate that human influence is warming the Earth's climate system, driving multiple climate impacts. Human-induced climate change will continue to get worse over the coming decades. decades, contributing to extreme weather, heat waves, drought, and coastal flooding due to sea level rise. Climate impacts will disproportionately impact poorer and more vulnerable communities who cannot afford to adapt. As a Christian, I find it helpful to view climate change through the lens of the creation fall redemption story of salvation history. The Christian story helps me to appreciate the beauty of a good climate system, whilst also acknowledging the brokenness of human-induced climate change, and the Christian story provides hope. As Richard Borkham has pointed out, our proximate hopes, such as our hope to avoid catastrophic climate change, should reflect our ultimate hope, but they are tempered by the constraints of a broken world. When our proximate hopes fail, our ultimate hope still stands. Christ will return to make all things new. Thanks for your faithful service through Unbelievable. Benjamin, thanks for getting in touch as well. Paul says, having spent the last 2 decades developing renewable energy technologies, I was excited to hear an episode on your show dedicated to climate change. First, I was concerned about putting your activist friend opposite someone with the academic credentials of Dr. Ross, but I was pleasantly surprised on 2 counts. First, Antonia was up on the salient points and managed to ground issues in our common humanity. Second, Hugh had a pretty nuanced take on the issues, which admittedly I should have expected from him. However, your comment in the show's epilogue about wanting to have had more of a climate denier really bothered me. Given the changes to our planet's weather and biology that we can already observe, claiming that climate change is a hoax is akin to claiming that the Earth is flat. It simply flies in the face of facts. Given the religious themes of your show, it would be great to have a conversation that explores the power dynamics and inherent moral issues of the climate change crisis. As both of your guests acknowledge, this is largely something that the wealthy industrialized countries have done, but the brunt of it is felt by the poor. It's also well established by now that Exxon and other oil and gas companies have known since the 1970s that burning their fuels would cause these problems, and not only covered it up, but intentionally created the climate denial movement and politicized the issue using an infrastructure that includes much of the white evangelical church in America. Antonia made some excellent points about how Jesus might have viewed this issue, and further exploration of that idea would be very interesting and potentially quite fruitful. As a Christian, working alongside many mostly liberal climate activists, these kinds of questions come up more than my insulated brethren might expect. And you go on to recommend a number of experts who might make good guests when we come back to this issue. Catherine K. Wilkinson, Dr. Melissa Lott, Dr. Leah Stokes, and a number of people got in touch as well via Twitter and elsewhere to recommend Dr. Catherine Hayhoe as well, who I know is a leading Christian in the area of climate science. Thank you very much for all the recommendations. Just one final one on this. Ben in Rochester Hills, Michigan says, wow, 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 what an interesting and enlightening show. Hugh Ross dramatically revealed how many practical and effective possibilities for dealing with climate issues we have at our disposal that are being completely ignored. On her side, Antonia seemed more committed to social reformation activities than to solving the climate issues. It was crazy that just about everything Antonia brought up, Hugh agreed with and had addressed in his book. Hugh's gentleness and reasoned responses gave honour to his saviour throughout the conversation. This episode left me with the sad conclusion that climate change continues to be used as a football for political ends rather than as a threat to human existence. A great episode to share with all those interested in climate in our lives. Thank you very much for all of those interesting responses to the show. Going back to yoga, Derek gets in touch to say, I unexpectedly enjoyed the episode on yoga with Mike Shreve and Chris James. One of the guests mentioned another's experience of discovering that Jesus is the way, truth and life, and reminded me of my own experience. For many years, I was a New Ager and Buddhist. When I came to Christ over 25 years ago, I still had those persistent beliefs in the back of my mind. One of them was a pluralist view of religion and spirituality, that while Jesus was my chosen path, other paths also led to God. Soon after my conversion, I purchased a very small comic book teaching Zen Buddhist meditation. I hiked up a mountain with the book and my Bible. It was an incredibly beautiful day, and I was exhilarated to be hiking in the forest. I sat on a very large granite boulder and laid both books in front of me. I read from my Bible and felt great. Then I reached for and touched the Buddhist book. I immediately perceived a change in the beautiful scenery around me. The light wasn't quite as bright, and where my mind previously highlighted numerous different hues of glowing green foliage, my mind now only highlighted the shading and shadows in between the beauty. I removed my hand from the book, and everything returned to normal. I was again able to perceive the forest beauty. I put my hand on the book a couple of more times to test the experience, but the same dimming effect happened each time. I even tried reading the book, thinking I could work past it, but it only got worse. I threw the Zen book in my bag, went back to the Bible to revel again in the natural beauty around me. It was then and there that I realized from this experience that Jesus is indeed the only way, truth, and life. I later tossed the Zen book in the garbage and never looked back, not once. Says Derek. Thank you very much, Derek. Interesting story. This one from Olivia. Quite a lengthy email here from Olivia, but an interesting one. I loved your podcast and find the debates usually evenly weighted, most enlightening. Possibly as I'm specializing in teaching yoga as a Christian, I found the recent podcast between Mike and Chris to be a little disappointing in this respect. I've had my spiritual home in the charismatic evangelical church for the last 27 years and was so familiar with Mike's position. I personally didn't feel Chris offered a different perspective, which I thought was a shame. While swallowing wholesale Mike's position for years, I've experienced and researched a different posture towards yoga as a Christian, which I wish could have been represented. There are many Christians in the US who are offering Christian yoga. And more recently, there are some of us in the UK, which is a really exciting ministry to be operating, as I've discovered. I suggest this alternative view needs to be heard for several important reasons. Here's why. The evolution of yoga. It's evolved a long way from the form it arrived in the UK in the middle of the 20th century and has become a very popular form of physical exercise. It's borrowed from Pilates, ballet, calisthenics, bodybuilding and other forms of strength and stretching exercises. For many people in the West, it is primarily used as a form of physical exercising. Not denying it has evolved from a wider yoga lifestyle and philosophy that is incompatible with Christian belief. It's been proven to be merely a form of exercise, though, for many who maintain it as such. Secondly, you want to say not all forms of yoga are dangerous. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. While some people might take up questionable forms of yoga, I would argue the Kundalini, while Mike became deeply entrenched in, is a form that I would always steer away from. Many, many people do not wander down unsavory spiritual avenues. You also go on to say nothing is evil in and of itself. The body is not evil in and of itself. A physical movement is not evil. Even the name yoga doesn't necessarily have spiritual attachments. Whilst there's always a call for Christians to preserve truth, doctrine, holiness, there's also a mandate to work out our faith with fear and trembling and innovate new forms as Christ and Paul did. Listening to a recent podcast you did with N.T. Wright, he speaks about how Paul does exactly this, standing at the intersection of three major cultures, seeking to make the gospel relevant, using language, argument and forms that were not Christian and using them to show how the gospel was relevant. You go on to say the Missio Dei and evangelistic opportunity. As an evangelist missionary, I found myself longing to connect people to God through the ways they already know, which relies on the theology of the Missio Dei. The well-being marketplace is a place that inspires me, using the forms of meditation as well as body movement and yoga to connect with people. But more than connect with people, as Christians might over a pub quiz trying to be relevant and form relationships, but more directly connect them to an experience of God. Yoga, that is physical exercise, is the best form of meditative movement, as it's slower, held postures, which gives one mindful attention to. There's a settling of the mind, which is an opportunity to help people feel more grounded in their own person, their own lives, and I believe in a discovery of God, who's always present and always at work. People can come to know Christ when they're calmer and can perhaps recognize the presence of the Holy Spirit. And there are accounts of people who have come to a knowledge of God on their yoga mat, i.e. through yoga practice. And you go on to say make other points, such as Christianity is always borrowed from culture. And in that sense, you know, there's nothing is impure and it in of itself should be excluded, including exercise, the body, and yes, yoga. And that everything can be used by God or by Satan. Yoga is great for well-being, as well as, in Mike's experience, an opportunity for the devil. Well, the devil can use anything. Yoga, sex, alcohol, money, women's rights, self-help, science. That doesn't mean Christians should completely abstain from any involvement in these things. And you go on to say that there's a massive opportunity to use yoga exercises to A, nourish believers spiritually, and B, bring unbelievers to an experiential awareness of God. And that's what you're personally seeking to do in your ministry, which is called Meaningful Meditation. Thank you very much for all of what you had to say. And sorry I haven't been able to read it in its entirety, Olivia. But I thought that was a very interesting perspective. And in many ways, you know, if we do the yoga issue again, perhaps, you know, we could bring you on, Olivia, to put that kind of perspective to a Christian who takes more of the Chris or Mike perspective on yoga. Very interesting. Thanks to everyone who's been in touch. Great to hear from you as ever. If you want to send your thoughts in, you can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I read all the emails. I can't read them all out on the show, but I do read them all and quite and respond to them as well. So thank you very much for being with me on this week's edition of the show. Let me tell you what's coming up next time. Does the church have a masculinity problem? Well, we covered this a couple of months ago in a sort of live stream with Christine Cobes-Dume. But Kyle Thompson from the US men's ministry Undaunted Life wanted an opportunity to respond to this topic. And he says the church does need to man up. The men aren't attracted to church because it's become too feminized. He's going to be on opposite Martin Saunders, author of The Man You're Made to Be, who takes a different perspective on this. Should be an interesting discussion. Hope you can join us for it. See you then.